Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Identity is one of the greatest issues of our time, fired up all the more by our frenzy of social media. It's an age in which what people think of us and why they think what they do of us. It's one of the great questions of our time. Every one of us is susceptible to this. My next guest is offering some significant answers on this very question of identity, tied inextricably to Jesus, whose resurrection we celebrate this Easter Sunday. Mark Driscoll is one of the most prominent and very often controversial voices on the world stage for the Christian faith today. He's the founding pastor of the Mars Hill Church in Seattle, USA, growing it from a handful of people in his lounge room to many sites based at 14 locations across four states in the US. Mark Driscoll is direct. He's no nonsense. He's a man's man who says, for instance, young men will not go to church so long as there are guys in dresses preaching to grandmas. Here's another one of his challenges. It's time for Christianity to man up and drop the image of Jesus as a long-haired man in a dress, drinking decaf and in touch with his feelings. Last year, Mark Driscoll and his wife Grace wrote the New York Times bestseller Real Marriage, The Truth About Sex, Friendship and Life Together. The book attracted a storm of controversy. Now he's addressing this critical issue of identity. I doubt it will attract anywhere near the media attention, but I reckon it demands the attention of every one of us, especially as we think deeply on this day. I'm so glad to say, Mark Driscoll, welcome to Open House.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. Mark, if we are to drop the image of Jesus as a long-haired man in a dress drinking decaf and in touch with his feelings, or as you've also said, a neutered, limp-wristed, popular sky fairy of pop culture, how should we, on this Easter day, be viewing Jesus?
Well, when we look back and we see Jesus in history and humility, he was in his early 30s, lived in a small town, worked a carpenter job with his dad, and walked a lot, slept outside sometimes, covered a lot of miles, probably had short hair. So you think of a working-class guy who's young and in pretty good shape. Of course, we know that he died. And then the big debate is, did he in fact rise from death? And for the few billion Christians on earth, we all say yes. He conquered death, and he conquered sin in his conquering of death, and then he returned to heaven once his mission was done to save sinners. And so if we saw him today, we wouldn't see him in humility. We'd see him in glory. We'd see him ruling and reigning as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and we'd see him in all of his majesty. And so I think it's really important not to just remember what Jesus was like on the earth, but remember what he's like right now.
Yes. Mark, I'm very keen to explore in depth the important things you're saying about identity in your new book. First, I'd like to explore a bit of your own life and ministry a bit. You were brought up as a Catholic, converted to Christian faith at 19. What was it about that defining moment for you?
Yeah, some Catholics are Christians and they love Jesus. I wasn't one of them. And in college, actually, for a philosophy class, I had to read Augustine's Confessions at a state university, of all things, and it kind of got me curious, and so I started reading the Bible on my own just out of curiosity, and came to believe that Jesus' claims to be God were true, and that he proved that through rising from death. And so my whole life flipped then at the age of 19, and I became a Christian, started attending a church, feeling a sense of calling toward ministry, and have been walking with Jesus ever since.
And Mars Hill had very small beginnings. Why did you kick off your own church and not join somebody else's?
Yeah, well, the city I'm in, Seattle, is actually quite a bit like Sydney or Melbourne. Mm. I mean, statistically, it's not very Christian. And there tend not to be large churches. We don't have anything like Hillsong anywhere near where I live. The churches tend to be quite a bit smaller for the most part. There's a few larger ones, but nothing really large. And in the city where the young people were, the college students and the singles, there just frankly weren't a lot of churches. And so it was at the time one of the least church cities in America. So I just decided I was going to start a Bible study to try and teach the Bible about Jesus to college students and singles, and it just kept growing. And so 16 years later, it's a church that, I mean, we're, you know, 20,000 plus for Easter on a good Sunday for us, which is the biggest Sunday of the year. So what started as 10, 12 people in the living room of my rental home on a couch has exploded into something much larger than I ever expected.
Not only the fastest growing church in the USA, but also one of the most innovative. What do you do that is different, that, for instance, you've seen such growth under God?
Yeah, well, being in the city, a lot of young creative types. We've got Microsoft and Amazon and Starbucks and Boeing and just a lot of companies here that, you know, people around the world would know. So there's a young, creative, urban, educated, single workforce. And so a lot of those people become Christians. We baptize over 1,000 people a year. Lots of people become Christians. And then they come with all of these gifts. They're musicians and filmmakers and graphic designers and code writers, and so they bring all of that innovation into the church. And so it really is more about just the people that we have and the skills that they bring with them. So we now have 14 locations across 4 states. We do video sermons. We've innovated technology. We've sold technology to, you know, we sold one piece of technology to a for-profit company for a couple $1 million. I mean, just a lot of innovation that comes out of the church. It's quite amazing, to be honest with you.
How much of it has to do with the way you both proclaim and live out Christian faith in that community? How much of it has to do with how you actually view the people in that community, and for that matter, I suppose, people who aren't in your community? How do you view them?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Jesus tells us to love our neighbor, and even if our neighbor isn't super excited about that, we still do want to love as well as we can. And so, you know, again, like Sydney, there are some misconceptions and misperceptions of Christianity and Christians. And so I think for the most part, you know, when people come to the church and they see a lot of young people, college educated, single, people who are, you know, look like the normal person that's living in the condos in the city, I think it surprises them because it's not what they were expecting to see in a church. I think they're oftentimes expecting to see a much older congregation, maybe not as into the technology or into the arts or music. And so, you know, for us, we love our city. We want to be good missionaries to our city. And just like a missionary going into another culture, we want to love the people, know the people, serve the people, and be available to answer any questions they've got.
What's the best thing about your role? What's the most challenging thing about your role?
I genuinely love teaching the Bible. I think I'm a Bible teacher at heart. So that's the best. I mean, for 16 years, I've had the great privilege of getting up to teach the Bible about Jesus every week. The hardest thing, quite frankly, is as our church has grown and we're spread across 14 locations across 4 states and even considering going international, just the complexity organizationally of trying to take care of, you know, so many people that are scattered geographically. It's like one big extended family, because it's really complicated to love and care for that many people.
Mm. You're a keen and frequently controversial observer and commentator on our culture, and often in trouble with the media. How much of that is how the media works? How much is that about how you work?
I mean, I'm no prophet, but I think that prophetic function is you say something and it gathers a lot of attention, and some people love it and some people hate it. And so that's been part of what I have enjoyed for my entire ministry. Sometimes I'll be honest with you and say that I'm shocked at sometimes the size of the audience for certain things or the backlash to it. At the same time, I know that if and when I say something wrong or say it in the wrong way, I need to be humble and apologize and try and make it right. But if it's true, then I'll just stand there and take my shots for it like I'm supposed to, and I'm okay with that.
And in that, you're not afraid to ruffle feathers?
No. Don't mind that at all. I love Jesus, and I'm trying to get stuff done, and that means there's going to be a little resistance to it. And that's okay. I still love the people who don't like me, and you know, I want them to meet Jesus, and if they do know Jesus, I want them to help me introduce more people to Jesus. So I'm a guy who's pretty driven, and I'm okay with whatever conflict or controversy I have to endure to see people meet Jesus.
None more so than your book last year, Real Marriage, The Truth About Sex, Friendship, and Life Together. It created such a storm of reaction. Any regrets about either that book or what followed?
No, I mean, you know, for those who I think are in more traditional or church cultures, you know, they may have found the second half of the book a bit too much. The first half of the book is really on marriage and friendship and forgiving one another. And the big idea is friendship, that marriage is in large part about friendship. And then the second half of the book is on sex within the context of marriage. And there's one chapter in there that's, you know, easily the most debatable. And it's where we try and answer a lot of the common questions that people have about sex within the context of marriage. And for me, they're questions that our people actually ask. I mean, I think last year we had 1,200 baptisms. So that's a lot of new Christians. And a large percentage of our church is single. And so they've been sexually active, sexually assaulted, sexually addicted, looking at pornography. They meet Jesus and or they get married. They got all kinds of questions, but it's not the typical questions that their grandparents had at the Baptist church. And so you got to answer those questions because people need answers to them. So, you know, it's not a perfect book. I think it's a good book. And I think what's interesting is, you know, you write out of what you know at the time. And then you get criticized a lot and you realize, oh, yeah, boy, that was helpful. Or, yeah, I kind of overlooked that. Or if I would have said it that way, I think it would have been more clear. But you do the best you can with where you're at. And overall, I still think it's an incredibly helpful book. And the big idea of friendship, I think, is a life changer for couples. And most couples, quite frankly, they're not really good friends. And I think that's the basis of a lot of their troubles.
On Open House, we're with Mark Driscoll, founder of the Mars Hill Church in the United States. So, Mark, with your latest book, Who Do You Think You Are? And you've written it as a kind of personal study for yourself and your 16-year-old daughter, Ashley, on this whole question of identity. Can I ask you this question about you first? Why do you need this? Do you struggle with the identity issue yourself?
Yeah, I do. And for me, to be honest with you, I can find my identity in my performance. You know, that can be, you know, it's 'cause my vocation is ministry, so it'd be like, is the church growing? You know, am I having an impact? Am I making a difference? You know, for those who are in business, it might be, is the company growing? Or for those who are students, it might be, what's my grade point average? Or so for me, though, a lot of it's in performance. That, and I find that when my identity is in my performance, then when I'm doing good and things are going well, I can get proud and arrogant and kind of self-righteous. And when things are going poorly, I can get really depressed and discouraged and sad. And then my emotional life is affected by my performance. And that's really not healthy, because what I'm arguing in the book is that our identity is in Christ. Our righteousness is in Christ. And so some things may explain us, but they don't define us. And it's a big idea that I need, and I use a lot in my parenting with our five kids, letting the kids know who they are in Christ. And then in our work in ministry, helping people know who they are in Christ. Because once you know who you are, then you know what to do. But if you don't know who you are, then you don't know what to do.
And for Ashley in particular, at the age of 15, and the many teens who listen to Open House, why do they particularly need to work through this whole question of identity?
Yeah, well, you just think about it. Like, let's talk about my daughter. My oldest is 15, and for her right now, I mean, so much of the pressure from friends and peers and boys and media and advertising is to create an identity. And so, you know, a lot of that comes down to body image and, are you dating anyone? Are you sexually active? How do you dress? Are you in a certain genre of music or style or subculture? How do you present yourself? And social media makes this more complicated than ever, because in social media, you have to create and then defend an identity. So it's like, what photos will I put up? What will I say? Who will I follow? What will I like? How will I respond to comments? What will I say about the bands I listen to and the places that I go and likes and dislikes? So much of our life now through social media is about identity formation and identity preservation. And people come on and they criticize you and they make nasty comments, and all of a sudden, you know, you're in a tailspin because they're attacking you and they're attacking your identity. I mean, in the age of social media, identity is a bigger issue than ever, and it's an incredibly important issue.
Which is why I think your book is so timely, all the more so. In it, you list some very significant identities for those who, as the Apostle Paul writes in the New Testament book of Ephesians, are in Christ. I'd love you to take us through briefly some of these identities. The first one is, I am appreciated. And the reason you deal with that is because you say we live in a rude world.
Yeah, we do. And for a lot of people, they don't really get any commentary from anyone unless it's criticism. This can be employers or customers or parents or coaches or teachers. And what Paul tells the Ephesians, he says, I never cease giving thanks for you. I mean, that's a huge statement. I mean, you know, he's basically saying, I appreciate you and I am thankful for you all the time, and I can't stop talking about how appreciative I am of you. I mean, there are people that have waited years to hear that from a spouse or a parent or a boss. Just, man, that was amazing. I really appreciate that. That meant the world to me, and I am so grateful for you. And what happens is we want that kind of appreciation, and when we hear that God in the Scriptures appreciates us and that God sees all that we do, so the things we do in secret, not just the bad things, but the good things, the sacrifices we make, the generosity we offer, the things that we do out of love for God when no one is looking, just because it's the right thing to do, that God sees and knows all of that, and he appreciates us, and he tells us that he's grateful for our obedience and our generosity. Well, for me, that's super, because now I don't have to use people for compliments. I don't need to use people for approval. I don't need to use people for my identity. God gives me appreciation, and then I can just go love and serve people with pure motives.
Another identity you highlight is that I'm reconciled. And to illustrate that, you tell a powerful story of Dr. John Perkins. Can you take us briefly through his story?
Yeah, well, his story was in the American South during the days of segregation and discrimination and, you know, horrific violence done against his family and prejudicial behavior. And he's a man who fled the South in an effort to start over and not be treated and abused like that. But then he got saved and met Jesus and felt that God was calling him back into the community and cultural context where he had grown up. To help bridge that racial barrier and to help those who were suffering and in need. And so his story is a beautiful one where the people that he, to some degree, was hated by and hated, he ended up moving back to love and to serve and to know and to build community with. And so I talk about how in the Bible, it talks about the reconciliation that happens in Christ and that Jesus takes away the hostility between races and nations and cultures and genders and socioeconomic backgrounds and such, and he creates a new group called Christian. And so it's black and white and young and old and rich and poor and male and female and all kinds of different people are now in one brand new category in Christ, and their family. The Bible goes so far as to say that they're like brothers and sisters, which is a pretty remarkable claim when people start out as enemies and then they all meet Jesus and they become a family.
Yes. There's one perhaps surprising identity that you highlight, and that is that I am afflicted, that those in Christ will suffer. It's going to be a very unpopular notion for many today.
Yeah, and in Ephesians chapter 3, which the book is based on, Paul starts off in verse 1, he says, I'm a prisoner for Jesus Christ. So he's writing the whole thing from jail. So he's in prison because he's a Christian. And then in verse 13, he says, quote, I am suffering. I'm suffering. And so, you know, what do you do with your pastor's in jail and he's writing you a letter and he talks about the fact that he's suffering for Christ. And then he goes on to tell the people, but I don't want you to lose heart. And so he's teaching that suffering is a natural part of the Christian life. It's certainly not something that we should look forward to, but we should expect. And from the Old Testament prophets who were persecuted and God's people who were often opposed to the New Testament Christians who were often opposed and incarcerated to Jesus himself who was murdered and put to death. You know, Christians should expect opposition and affliction in this world. And the situation then is, I say we like to ask a lot of why questions. God, why did this happen and why did that happen? And Paul wants us to ask who questions, like who is Jesus, who am I, and who can I help through my suffering? And how could God use my suffering to teach me more about the Jesus who suffered for me and teach me to become more like Jesus through my suffering? And so, you know, I think sometimes Christianity is wrongly taught as if you give your life to Jesus, everything will get better. And the truth is, if you give your life to Jesus, it might actually get worse.
And yet, as you illustrate in another one of these identities, you are also loved deeply in Christ,
totally.
Unconditionally.
Yeah, the love that God has for his people is a love that, quite frankly, we have a hard time even getting our minds around.
Yes.
You know, that God would love his enemies, that he would adopt them into his family, that he'd make them his kids, that he would have an eternal inheritance for them. And what that means is, for Christians, there's nothing you can do to make God love you more, and there's nothing you can do to make God love you less. And so the love is not predicated or conditioned in any way on your performance, but on Jesus. And so for us, I mean, it's just, that sounds radically contrary to everything. I mean, even in our day when people have prenuptial agreements in their marriage saying, you know, if you do this or don't do that, then I'm not going to love you anymore. I mean, we actually negotiate that at the front end of the marriage. And God doesn't do that. God doesn't operate in that way.
There is so much more that we could cover, but I'll leave the book with people to explore for themselves so many useful and helpful identities of being in Christ. But can I ask you this finally on this Easter day? What would you say to someone listening tonight who might be somewhat engaged with this Jesus that they're listening to Open House, but without considering themselves in Christ? What would you say to them on this particular night?
Yeah, that Jesus should not be somewhere on your priority list, but he should be at the center of everything. That your work needs to be connected to Jesus, that your spending needs to be connected to Jesus, that your relationships need to be connected to Jesus, that your suffering needs to be connected to Jesus, that that all of who you are and all that you have and all that you do needs to be connected to Jesus. And I think sometimes people will say, well, I appreciate Jesus or I respect Jesus, but he really falls somewhere on their priority list, and he's not at the center of everything. And so that would be my encouragement, is to get to know Jesus for who he is and make sure that everything in your life is connected to him.
Mark Driscoll, I'm so glad that you've joined us on this night. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on Open House.
My great pleasure. Thank you, sir.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.